Today at Reader's Corner, Mia Bay, author of To Tell the Truth Freely, The Life of Ida B. Wells.
By her late 20s, she's known as Iola, Princess of the Press, and she has done well enough as a newspaper woman to actually buy a portion of a paper called The Free Speech. Wells began to think lynching really wasn't about sexual violence or crime, that it was about whites cutting down black men who were ambitious. She sees the Civil Rights Act of 1875 get overturned. She sees the decline over her early youth, and that's one of the reasons why she emerges as such an activist.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Born to slaves in 1862, Ida B. Wells came of age at a time when opportunities for smart and outspoken black women were extremely limited. That didn't stop her from becoming a fearless anti-lynching crusader, a women's rights advocate, a journalist, and one of the founders of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Always militant in her quest for racial justice, Wells didn't stay a member of the NAACP or any other organization for long. Her refusal to accept any compromise on racial inequality caused her to be labeled a dangerous radical in her day, but made her a model for later civil rights activists, as well as a powerful witness to the troubled racial politics of her era. In her biography, To Tell the Truth Freely, historian Mia Bay vividly captures the legacy and life of Ida B. Wells, from her childhood in Mississippi to her early career in late 19th century Memphis and her later life in progressive era Chicago. Dr. Bay teaches history at Rutgers University and is the Associate Director of Rutgers Center for Race and Ethnicity. She joins us by phone for this interview. Mia Bay, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Well, let's start with why. Why did you choose to do this biography on a woman who is largely forgotten in today's world of the recognizing from month to month the heroes of the various movements, the civil rights movement, for example, that moves through the calendar? Why Ida B. Wells?
Well, I'm a historian with a lot of training in 19th century history, and someone was talking to me about doing a biography of a 19th century black woman, and I realized that there were virtually no biographies of 19th century black women, and that few people could name any 19th century black women, except with a possible exception of, Harriet Tubman or Sojourner Truth. So Ida B. Wells struck me as a really good candidate because she had an interesting career as well, and also because people are beginning to remember and look for women such as Ida B. Wells. So it was time.
Give us a brief rendition of her bio from her birth in, 1862, and her traveling through this era, the latter part of the 19th and the early 20th century.
She was born into slavery in Holly Springs, Mississippi in 1862, while the war is still going on. She grows up in this sort of newly free world. Her parents are skilled. Her father's a carpenter. Her mother's a cook. They do quite well, and the kids go to school. But then in 1878, there's a terrible yellow fever epidemic in the Mississippi Valley, and both of Ida's parents die, along with one of her little brothers. She's the oldest of eight children, and she has to. She ends up dropping out of school and beginning to teach elementary school to support them. So she has very, very hard childhood. She's 16 when her parents die, and she ends up teaching in these rural schools for at least a half a decade before she finally moves to Memphis. But somehow, in amidst all this, she manages to hold on to her ambitions and educate herself, because her schooling really wasn't finished when she dropped out of school. And she starts writing. She starts publishing articles, often about things that disturb her in the world around her. And that's the beginning of her career as a journalist. And it takes off. Her articles, which she initially publishes in a little Baptist newspaper out of Memphis, get picked up by other newspapers. She starts to have a reputation. And by her late 20s, she writes under this nickname, Iola. And she's known as Iola, Princess of the Press. And she has done well enough as a newspaper woman to actually buy a portion of a paper called The Free Speech. And she's feeling pretty good. She's made it. She's doing well in Memphis. But then comes this terrible lynching in which three men are lynched, one of whom is a very close friend of Ida B. Wells, a postman named Thomas Moss, who with his wife are some of her best friends in Memphis. And Wells, who's out of town when this lynching occurs, comes back to find her friend dead, blacks in Memphis very scared, and she sort of tries to reconstruct what happened, and she begins to find out more and more about lynching, which at that time was very often explained as something that basically happened to black men because they were rapists or because they looked at white women or assaulted white women. But the lynching in Memphis, which took place in 1892, didn't have any of those things going on. It was basically a dispute that started with two boys fighting over a game of marbles, one black boy, one white boy, a dispute then involving the fathers and other men in the community. And it just escalated from there. But it was also very much encouraged by a white man who was a business competitor of Thomas Moss and the other two that were lynched. So Wells began to think that lynching really wasn't about sexual violence or crime, that it was about whites cutting down black men who were ambitious, who got ahead. And as she began to research lynching, she began to find that that was often the case, and that most lynchings didn't involve any accusation of sexual impropriety. And then she also began to find out that when they did involve some accusation of sexual impropriety, it was usually a reference to a consensual relationship. So she wrote as much in her paper, and she was fortunate enough to be out of town when her editorial came out, because a white mob descended on her paper and destroyed it and basically left word that should the editor of the paper ever come anywhere near them, they would kill him, because they actually thought the editorial was written by a man.
This period you're describing now, if I may interrupt, it differs considerably from her really younger years when she was growing up during Reconstruction. And right. And I think what's so interesting about your book is the way you help us remember that there was this period when the Lincoln Republicans really were attempting to realize the dream of the Emancipation Proclamation. Mm-hmm. So describe for us, before we get to what's going to happen next in Ida B. Wells' life, what it was like in those years when blacks did have rights and they did vote and et cetera.
That is one of the most interesting things one finds reading about Wells' life and the lives of other people during that period, is that, you know, emancipation is this long dreamed upon release. And then during Reconstruction, when blacks get the vote, there's a real vision of racial democracy among African Americans. They know it's contested. Ida B. Wells' father was a member of a Republican club, and they had to patrol their meetings with guns because the Klan might attack them. But he fought to use his vote, and he thought that if blacks were able to use their votes, that they could really transform the South. And that's the atmosphere that Ida grew up in, and that I think is one of the reasons she was so sort of steadfast in fighting for a return to some sort of racial democracy after that air gives way and after blacks lose the vote and segregation starts to become the rule everywhere. She has a sense that there were possibilities that are lost, and she literally sees them disappearing. She sees the Civil Rights Act of 1875 get overturned. She sees the railroads go towards colored cars. She sees the decline over her early youth, and that's one of the reasons why she emerges as such an activist.
And as far as the railroads turning into colored cars, that was really one of her causes, was it not?
Yeah, it was. Well, that was, you know, that was a very personal one for her, because She rode the railroad as a teacher. She taught in rural schools. And starting in the 1880s, she traveled by railroad, which was a relatively new way of commuting at that time. She had previously traveled by mule. And one day when she tried to sit down, the conductor told her she couldn't sit down. She was in a lady's car, and she needed to go to the smoking car. And these were the old divisions between the first class and the second class car, where women got the nicer car and men got the smoking car. But at this time, they were moving towards making them racial, and Wells ended up being thrown off the train because she wouldn't move, and then she sued. This happened to her twice. She sued again. She ultimately lost her suits, so she won in the lower courts, and this was a real political awakening for her. It occurred when she was in her early 20s, and it made her understand. I mean, she sort of literally was seeing rights disappearing, because she had been riding in the ladies' car prior to the first incident, and clearly there was a shift going on.
You're listening to Mia Bay. She is the Rutgers University professor of history who has written To Tell the Truth Freely, The Life of Ida B. Wells. Now, let's get back to the lynching, because the case that really hit me the hardest was the case of Henry Smith. And I wonder if you could describe what role this plays in her life. His lynching wasn't just a lynching. It was horrible, brutal violence of the worst sorts. And then to be watched and enjoyed by thousands upon thousands of people, apparently, along a train ride. He was on the train and they were bringing him back to justice, I guess. And people would gather around those train stations to applaud what was going to happen to this guy.
Yeah, there was a period, which is hard to believe it ever was, there was a period in the late 19th, early 20th century where lynchings were these public spectacles, and they had a kind of script. Someone would be jailed on suspicion of something, and there would be a kind of general decision that this person would be lynched, and it would actually be announced in advance, and people would charter railroad cars to go see the lynching. They would bring their children. If you've ever seen some of the photo lynching postcards, you can actually see, you know, the way in which lynching was a spectacle. You can see the spectators. You can see the kids. And Henry Smith was a particularly outstanding case of that. It was just enormous numbers of people came to see it. And it sort of quite, it shocked the world. It was sort of almost the height of these spectacle lynchings.
Well, as we move through her life, she's in Memphis, I believe, when this is going on, and then she finds her way to progressive era Chicago. What changes in Ida B. Wells' life as she moves out of the South and into the so-called North?
Well, she moves because she really has to move because of the death threats against her in Memphis. And she ends up going abroad for several years, for two trips, promoting anti-lynching, and ends up resettling in Chicago. And her life changes dramatically. After she leaves the South, she meets the man who will become her husband, Ferdinand Barnett, who's a lawyer who works out of Chicago. And they get married and have four children fairly shortly after they marry. And so she becomes a different, you know, she becomes a wife and mother. She, before she gets married, even while she's initially seeing Barnett, she's still traveling a lot. That's when she goes to Britain. But after she gets married and have kids, she continues to be an activist, but she never travels quite as widely or has quite the same influence, because Wells's trips to Britain and her promotion of or mobilization of anti-lynching sentiment there made her very, very well known, especially after the second trip she took. She got a lot of British support. They formed an anti-lynching society. British aristocrats and other well-known British people began to write to Southern governors, to the New York Times, to all sorts of American venues, to inquire about lynchings, to protest them. And this, more than anything else, more than what Wells said, but the sort of British interference, as the American papers often called it, got Wells a lot of attention, a lot of it negative, but still she became very well known.
So did it have any real impact on lynching itself? Certainly casting an international spotlight on something as violent and unfair as lynching, you'd think that at least having... I'm sure that people were scoffing at the fact that Britain was getting involved in our domestic politics, but nonetheless,
right.
you'd think it would have some impact.
I think it did. I mean, it's difficult to measure. Lynchings would eventually start to go down over the course of the early 20th century, and it's difficult to measure. There's so many different factors why that could have happened. But if you look at a state level, some states talked about anti-lynching measures. A few actually adopted them. The southern governors clearly felt more answerable when they had someone in custody, and that goes doubly true for the north. So I think it had some effect, not as much as Wells would have liked, because racial violence continued to be endemic throughout the early 20th century. But I think it had some effect, and it certainly changed the way that the public discourse about lynching in the North, at least, because prior to Wells's campaign, there really wasn't such thing as anti-lynching. Lynching was presented as this sort of necessary remedy for black criminality. And after Wells's campaign, it really became more of an embarrassment.
When you look back on the history of the civil rights movement and the earlier movement Ida B. Wells was a part of, you remember names like Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington and maybe even W.E. Du Bois. But on the other hand, when it comes to Ida B. Wells, you don't conjure up that name as quickly as you do those mm-hmm. others. And you point out in your book that she clearly differed from some of her male activist counterparts mm-hmm. and was mm-hmm. viewed as being more radical than they were, because she wasn't the accommodationist that Booker T. Washington was. Mm-hmm. Do you think that accounted? Is that what accounted for the fact that we don't know about her today, because she was shelved as somebody who just didn't speak to white America or something?
I think that's a big part of it. You know, when she was traveling around and sort of at the height of her fame, a lot of black leaders talked about her as sort of the logical heir to Frederick Douglass, who was very old at the time. And Booker T. Washington was a little bit less well known prior to his Atlanta speech in 1895. But what really propelled Booker Washington into enormous public thing is that he got very much taken up by whites who liked his message, whereas, well, whites did not like her message. I mean, not most whites. It was radical even for blacks. So I think that very much held her back. She was also not good at compromising. Washington was an accommodationist, as you say, who could really find middle ground with almost anybody. And Wells was more or less the opposite of that. So that held her back. And I think also her gender probably held her back. I think that there was a way in which a woman was not going to be sort of the next big black leader during this time period.
Well, there's just no question that she played this incredible role in the life of the movement, and yet was she as well educated and prepared for the role as Booker T. and Frederick Douglass were?
Well, Booker T. Washington and Wells were both born in slavery and had a limited education. Booker T. Washington did complete Hampton, but that wasn't very much higher education at that time. A lot of black colleges were more like high school. Wells didn't even do that. They were part of a generation of leaders, much like Frederick Douglass, who were, you know, had slave origins and were self-educated. But the next generation would be very different, and that's where Wells would be left out. You know, Du Bois would come along, and he had a PhD from Harvard, and newspapers would write about him as the smartest black man in America. And increasingly, by the early 20th century, it's becoming important in the black community for a person to have a higher education, now that there are people who have it. So in that sense, her leadership would also kind of become of a different generation, and one increasingly that wasn't a kind of leadership that increasingly was not mainstream.
So what was her role in founding the NAACP?
Well, she and a number of black journalists and leaders had been trying to found, had been aware that there was a need for some sort of national civil rights organization really since the 1880s, and had been involved in various sort of previous incarnations of this, an organization called the Afro-American Council, the Niagara Movement, where they all kind of met and tried to figure out how to do this. So Wells was part of this last attempt, which was actually the NAACP differed from the previous ones in the sense that it involved whites as well as blacks. It came together around the riots that took place in Springfield on Lincoln's birthday, which shocked everyone. And it brought together white reformers and these black leaders who have been trying to create a national organization. And finally, really, it got off the ground. And Wells was at the first meeting and some of the early meetings, though she did not get picked for any leadership position and would ultimately become alienated by the NAACP fairly soon.
You're listening to Mia Bay. She is the Rutgers University professor of history who has written To Tell the Truth Freely, The Life of Ida B. Wells. We were talking before the show, Mia, about the fact that I come from Chicago, and the only way I knew the word Ida B. Wells was because they named this housing project after her, and it was created in 1941, and it was to be segregated. And in the 50s and 60s, there are many fine stories of black families who succeeded and survived that project and can tell wonderful stories about doing so. But then the place fell into disrepute, and gang violence and drug dealers took it over, and the rest is history. And it just seems a bit odd to me that this woman who's forgotten in history has one thing named after her in Chicago, and it's segregated housing, the thing she fought against in her life and era. Your thoughts on how weird that is?
Well, it's both weird and not weird, because especially in the later part of her life, Wells was living in Chicago when this great migration of black people to Chicago really gets going. And, you know, one problem she constantly confronted was the fact that things weren't open to African-Americans. So young men would come to Chicago to work, and they couldn't stay at the YMCA. They couldn't stay at most of the places that white men could stay. And at one point, she even set up and ran her own club called the Negro Fellowship League that had, you know, places where people could stay. So I think she actually would have been, for all that it was segregated, been supportive of public housing. She was fiercely racially egalitarian, but she also lived in an era when sometimes the choice was either segregated accommodations or no accommodations whatsoever.
Sure.
In which case she would support segregated accommodations.
Right. You know, I wonder when you're leading a life like Ida B. Wells lived, especially in Chicago, since that's more of a reference point for me. When I lived in Chicago, the Urban League and the NAACP, the leaders of those groups on a regular basis interacted with the white power structure. They'd be on the dais at the Chicago City Chamber of Commerce meetings, and they'd be on a dozen different daises. Wherever the next annual meeting was, you'd find them working together, holding hands together oftentimes, differing, of course, in some cases when it came to legislation of one kind or another. In her era as a black woman, did she even get the opportunity to interact with directly the so-called white power structure of a city, whether it was Memphis or Chicago? I wonder how that worked for her.
Sometimes she did. She was active, actually, in Chicago politics and helped get at least one Republic, I think it was Oscar LaPriest, elected. And she, at one point, she got funding for the Negro Fellowship League from a very wealthy Chicago donor. So she had some access through her public speaking at various liberal, reform-minded venues. She was connected with a variety of reformers around the city. Though she did, I mean, she had a tendency to be too radical and alienate a lot of these people. So in the end, I think she didn't really have a good ongoing relationship with a lot of these power brokers.
And again, for our listeners who I'm sure have figured this out, we've mentioned it earlier, in Ida B. Wells' lifetime and career, she was working on what I referred to as the Republican side of the aisle, as opposed to the Democratic side of the aisle, given the role the Republicans played from the Civil War forward in emancipation. And so that's a little strange for people today when you sit there and talk about Ida B. Wells working for a Republican to get him elected. That's not exactly the same party that is alive and well today.
I know. Well, it's funny, I mean, because depending on how you are, I mean, the complete flip has really come since the Civil Rights Movement, because prior to the Civil Rights Movement, you know, the Solid South was a Democratic South, and it was the party of white supremacy, and things have changed.
Well, the fact that she's slipped from national attention, from the national stage, certainly didn't prevent you from doing this book, and of course the book itself is going to help put her back up onto that stage. I'd like to talk about the role of biography for a moment. First of all, because for me, biography is a way to learn history, and your book has done an excellent job of covering the last half of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. And for those who really want a realistic dose of what life was like in that era, the life of Ida B. Wells is really the case in point. So I guess the question becomes whether or not you feel that young people today who have so many of the rights and privileges that Ida B. Wells was denied and that she fought for, can they appreciate what was denied to those who came before them and how valiantly people like Ida B. Wells had to fight for it? Do you ever get frustrated as a history professor thinking about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, because young people can be very, you know, fatalistic and feel, you know, they'll be disgusted with the world and feel like they can't change it. And, you know, as a person who teaches African-American history, I feel like, you know, it is so clear you can change the world. And a lot of these people like Ida B. Wells and so forth, they literally felt like they had to change the world before they could do anything at all. And it's sort of a level of both personal and political ambition that it's heartening to know it's there, but it's obviously not something that people not everyone has.
Now, in her particular case, she did, and I think you alluded to this in the book, she did have a little bit of a personal problem with her temper that I believe you say she acknowledged that may have stood in the way of perhaps getting more acclaim or acceptance into the so-called power structure.
Yeah, she really did not last for very long in any organization that had many other members, because she was almost, I mean, it was both political and temperamental. She was almost always more radical in her agenda, and then she would get very frustrated and really just kind of walk out or, you know, say something, and that would be the end of it.
Well, we've run out of time, but I want to tell you, Mia, I've really enjoyed the book. I think it's just a great way to learn about this incredible movement from the time of the Civil War through the first third of the 20th century. I think you've done a great job of telling the story of a woman who should not be long forgotten, the life of Ida B. Wells. Thank you for joining us today on Reader's Corner. Again, the book is To Tell the Truth Freely, The Life of Ida B. Wells by Mia Bay. Next week, Don E. Carlton, author of Conversations with Cronkite, a first-person look at the legendary newsman whose career chronicled the great events of the late 20th century. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.